Hi, Christian Yordanov here. I'm a functional health practitioner, author. My latest book is How to Actually Live Longer, Volume 1, all about longevity. If you're into that topic, please check it out. Check out the book. It's pretty, I'd say, informative. A lot of practical and easy to implement strategies on how to increase your longevity. Now, today I want to talk to you about a little bit about serotonin. This is a very deep discussion. There's a lot of research that I have yet to dig deep into, but my goal is to at least convey to you that serotonin A is not the happy neurotransmitter or hormone or chemical, and we do not want to increase it. Whatever we do, we don't want to increase it, right? There's no benefits to increasing it, only detriments. And two, you knowing this information is going to be helpful in case you were ever put in a position where a person in a butcher coat offers you a chemical synthesized by a company that is very likely to have paid billions in criminal damages and lawsuits on account of their fraud and crimes in order to raise your serotonin level because they might think it will help you. So if I can help even one person prevent that from happening, I would consider that a success. I have seen what these chemicals, these drugs do to people, and it's pretty horrific, right? Someone close to me was on these quote-unquote antidepressants, SSRIs, and it was very ugly. And I've some clients that have been on them, and nothing good comes out of them, right? So this is basically a money-making scam where they marketed serotonin as the quote-unquote happy chemical. And for decades now, they've been making crap loads of money whilst poisoning people, right? So that's just the reality of the situation. We're all adults here. I feel like there's no need to tiptoe through the tulips, right? That's the reality of the situation. So we need to protect ourselves from this, okay? In 2020, in the USA, some 45 million antidepressant prescriptions were written, right? That's a lot of people. Of those, more than 2 million were for children. People under the age of 17, right? So it's bad. It's bad. And the worst part is, right, that even if someone is quote-unquote depressed, increasing their serotonin is not the solution. In fact, as you'll see later, serotonin is often elevated in depression, right? But let's start from the beginning. What is serotonin if it's not the happy chemical, right, as it's been marketed? So what was interesting for me when I started doing the research last year is if you even go to Wikipedia right now, you will see, I've got some snippets here I'll read from the Wikipedia article. You'll see very plainly that it's not a happy chemical, right? So listen to this. This is from Wikipedia, so it's not controversial by any means. So besides mammals, serotonin is found in all bilateral animals, including worms and insects, as well as fungi and in plants. So it's you could say it's a primordial chemical shared by a lot of life, right? I don't want to say all life, but a lot of life, right? And other snippets from Wikipedia, serotonin is one compound of the poison contained in stinging nettles. So if you ever as a kid were playing in the dirt, the forest, and you touch the stinging nettle, you know what that feels like. That is mediated, that sort of stinging, itchiness and redness, that's mediated largely by things like serotonin, histamine, and so on, right? Other things, serotonin is present in insect venoms and plant spines, serves to cause pain, which is also a side effect of serotonin injection. Serotonin is produced by pathogenic amoeba causing diarrhea in the human gut. The gastrointestinal parasite Entamoeba histolytica secretes serotonin, causing a sustained secretory diarrhea in some people. Patients infected with Entamoeba histolytica have been found to have highly elevated serum serotonin levels, which return to normal following a resolution of the infection. Entamoeba histolytica also responds to the presence of serotonin by becoming more virulent. This is from Wikipedia. Serotonin is a common component of invertebrate venoms, salivary glands, nervous tissues, and various other tissues across mollusks, insects, crustaceans, scorpions, various kinds of worms, and jellyfish. In plants, serotonin synthesis seems to be associated with stress signals. So this is where kind of, once you start digging into it, it actually turns out that serotonin is more of a stress hormone than anything, right? Then there is a very delicate balance between physiological role of gut serotonin and its pathology. In other words, you need very little serotonin in the body. You need some serotonin. See, none of these things are necessarily inherently bad. When we say these things, I mean, you know, histamine, cortisol, estrogen, serotonin, prolactin, adrenaline. They're not bad. They are required for our functioning, normal functioning and survival, but they're required in very tiny amounts at very specific times. So when there's too much of it, like cortisol, adrenaline, you're all amped up, you can't sleep, you're agitated, irritable, estrogen, it will mess with your, you know, hormones and mood and sleep and pain and can cause cancer. So these things are required in tiny amounts for specific purposes, and then they have to be, the body has to keep keep them in check, right? So then what else? Again, this is from Wikipedia. Some serotonergic agonist drugs cause fibrosis anywhere in the body, particularly the syndrome of retroperitoneal fibrosis, as well as cardiac valve fibrosis. Fibrosis is like a scarification of the tissues. You're laying down collagen. So it does have a quote-unquote healing role in specific times and injuries, but if those serotonin receptors are activated too much because of there's a lot of serotonin systemically, that can drive that fibrosis, and that fibrosis drives pathology, dysfunction. It eventually can lead to cancer in organs. So that's, and this is this final quote from Wikipedia tells it all, really. Despite its long-standing prominence in pharmaceutical advertising, the myth that low serotonin levels cause depression is not supported by scientific evidence. That's from Wikipedia, right? So they know that most people won't do the research. When you go to your person in a butcher coat, they know best, allegedly. And whatever they say goes, and you know, you just follow instructions like a good little, you know, whatever. You know, that's I hate this attitude of looking down upon the person coming to you for help, and you're looking like they're looking down on you, and like you're nothing, you're nobody, you just do as you're told, right? Well, that's bullshit, right? A true practitioner that wants to help a person there, it's a partnership, right? You don't tell the client what to do necessarily. You you coach the client how to help themselves, right? There is no, like, this sort of God complex is ridiculous, right? That a lot of doctors have, where, you know, they're as if they're healing you or anything. It's the body that heals. All the practitioner should do is help the person identify the things that require addressing in terms of imbalances, poor lifestyle choices, dietary choices, deficiencies, and then, you know, helping them implement the program, right? It's not about take this thing, stop that symptom for a while, come back when you have other symptoms. That's so ridiculous, so kindergarten level, right? So to have a God complex over that, for me, it's preposterous. And it's kind of the craziness of the world we live in right now. Now, what else here? So what's important to understand is in animals, humans included, only about 5% of the body's serotonin resides in the brain. Most of the body's serotonin is housed in the gut, with 90% of that being stored in the enterochromaffin cells, where it's created. Most of it is synthesized in these enterochromaffin cells. And then there's some other myenteric neuron, interneurons that create the rest of it. But basically, most of it is in these enterochromaffin cells, right? So they can also secrete it in the bloodstream. And then that serotonin in the bloodstream can be taken up by the platelets, as they're known. And basically, these platelets can release it at certain times when injury is sensed, right? So the important thing to understand is that most of the serotonin is actually made in the gut, in the body, some 90, 95% of it. And it has roles like in gastric motility. So for example, if you eat something bad or some quote-unquote pathogenic organism enters the gut and the body recognizes that, the serotonin can be increased, and that will cause you to expel whatever injurious toxin, food, pathogen, whatever else, out quickly, because it will increase digestive motility, and you're going to basically have diarrhea and get it out of you, right? So that is a role it that serotonin fulfills, right? Now, in terms of what it can do in the body, serotonin is that, this is again from some papers that I've been kind of looking over, extracting interesting quotes and stuff like that. So experimental data suggest that serotonin drives fibrosis in the skin and visceral organs, right? Already mentioned that. High levels of serum, so blood serotonin, are predictive of an increased risk for hip fracture, non-vertebral osteoporotic fracture, and incident fractures among older men. So that's not good either. By the end of the 1950s, it was widely accepted that migraine headaches and associated symptoms, including nausea and visual disturbances, were caused by an excess of serotonin, and anti-serotonin drugs of various types were being used for treatment. And what else? Too much extracellular serotonin in the intestinal lining is harmful and can cause irritable bowel syndrome, characterized by symptoms of pain, diarrhea, constipation, indigestion, bloating, and headache. So what's interesting is that the serotonin blocking drug cyproheptadine, that actually has, I think it's, there's, I've seen one study where it actually was helpful for people with irritable bowel syndrome. And you're thinking, like, it's an antihistamine actually. So it's a serotonin and histamine blocking, and it's an anticholinergic drug. I think it was, it's from the 1960s, so it's quite old, not really interesting to pharma companies, but it's still available in some countries. Even it's over the counter from the pharmacy, but it's kind of interesting that irritable bowel syndrome can have a component of high serotonin. And what's interesting as well is if, as you see later, I'll discuss the fact that in depression, serotonin is actually elevated often. So if, and I did a last week I did an episode on depression, anxiety, and insomnia, how they're all connected. Actually, at least a third of folks with depression have, I think, have constipation, but there's a big component of gut dysfunction in depression, anxiety, and bipolar disorder and stuff like that. So it's also interesting how, if you tie in serotonin here, it starts to make sense. So serotonin can be part of IBS, can be elevated, contributing to IBS. It can be elevated in depression, but also gut dysfunction is a common feature of depression, anxiety, things like that. So these things are, as always, very much interconnected. And that's why there's been studies where this cyproheptadine not only helps people with depression, like it can completely resolve it for some people, it can also help with various gut issues like irritable bowel syndrome and a bunch of other stuff. So it's kind of, if you boil it down back to the mechanisms, it looks like serotonin is a major culprit in these things. And then we won't even get into the cancer and the sort of the fibrosis side of things too much here, but just, it's interesting. It's always interesting to get more pieces of the puzzle, and then you're like, oh, okay, that makes sense. So that drives this, and then you're like, so what do we do? At the end of the day, it gives us simple things to do to prevent these imbalances from occurring. I guess kind of that's where I'm going with this. Now, this is a quote from 2015 from a dude called Paul Andrews, assistant professor in the department of psychology, neuroscience and behavior in McMaster University, USA. Now, this is the quote from this dude. Nearly all commonly prescribed antidepressant medications perturb serotonin, an ancient chemical that is found in plants, fungi, and animals. In recent work published in Frontiers in Psychology, we have found that antidepressant medications have adverse health effects on every major process in the body regulated by serotonin, including mood, attention, neuronal growth and death, reproductive functioning, electrolyte balance, digestive functioning, platelet activation, and the clotting process. By interfering with numerous adaptive processes, antidepressants appear to degrade the overall functioning of the body. Let me just repeat that. By interfering with numerous adaptive processes, antidepressants appear to degrade the overall functioning of the body. And then it says, in the elderly, antidepressant use is associated with an increased risk of death, the magnitude of which is arguably greater than the risk of cardiac events caused by the painkiller Vioxx. Such evidence suggests that antidepressants do more harm than good. Of course, they're still on the market, and they will be on the market for decades longer. You know, this is kind of the insidious nature of a lot of these chemicals, is they cause dysfunction and degeneration and all this stuff, a disease. They do it very slowly, right? So something like thalidomide and stuff, where babies were born without limbs, and just kind of all these other horrible drugs where people die very quickly. You know, people catch on very quickly to that. So the insidious nature of these other things, like birth control pills that raise estrogen and mess with the hormone balance, they cause disease and other dysfunction, but it takes years to develop. So it's very difficult to pinpoint it back to a specific thing, right? But people are wisening up to this. They're wisening up, right? Now, what was interesting for me is, I just stumbled on a study called Pharmacology of Serotonin and Female Sexual Behavior. This is very interesting for some reasons now. So this is from that study. It's kind of a review paper. There's quite a lot of animal research that they cite there, but some of the summaries that the researchers give us include things like, although findings were not always consistent, the bulk of evidence supported the hypothesis that compounds that increased serotonin reduced female sexual behavior, and compounds that decreased serotonin facilitated sexual behavior. So things that increase serotonin reduce libido, sexual behavior in females, whereas things that decrease serotonin facilitate sexual behavior. So things like dopamine and stuff like that, which serotonin and dopamine are fairly antagonistic. So that's kind of interesting. Why are so many women being pushed these antidepressants? Because there's a much bigger segment of the population that is female getting pushed these drugs. Do they want women to have lower libido and, you know, have sex less and maybe have less children? I don't know. Not a conspiracy theorist, but man, you know, you read enough things, you start to kind of put pieces together. And anyway, most antidepressants can produce sexual dysfunction in human females, but SSRIs are associated with the highest incidence. And the most prevalent complaint following SSRI treatment is related to low sexual desire and satisfaction. In fact, there's a whole thing called, what's it called? Post-SSRI sexual dysfunction. That's a syndrome or a thing now that's recognized. And yeah, so what else from this article? I think that is enough. I think that's enough said, right? So interesting, before I found this out, when my wife was having her insomnia, sort of postpartum, she went through a time of insomnia, the feeding schedule, the breastfeeding schedule messed up her sleep and so on. And there was a massive challenge of figuring things out to help her sleep. And one of the things we did try was 5-HTP. Now, you may have heard of 5-HTP, 5-hydroxytryptophan. That's the precursor to serotonin. And serotonin can become melatonin. So that was my, that was my rationale for trying it. And if you listen, anyone you ask, even right now, that's even a naturopath or nutritionist or doctor, everybody will tell you you need more serotonin if you're not feeling well or depressed or you have mood issues. And a lot of most natural practitioners will be, you know, serotonin is good. And I think people are slowly waking up to the marketing scam of Big Pharma, but it's going to take decades again, because there's so much literature that is supportive of these hypotheses, like the cholesterol hypothesis, all these things, you know. So it's going to take ages. So at least you now know that if you're ever struggling with sleep or mood stuff, blah, 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 the 5-HTP is probably the last supplement you want to add. Now, it might help. You see, these things can help in the short term, but it's the long-term ramifications that we need to be wary of. So I would never use tryptophan ever again. I would never recommend it. The tryptophan is the amino acid precursor to 5-hydroxytryptophan, which then can then become serotonin. So I would not use that. And what's interesting is if you look at the protein content of all foods, plant or animal foods, whey protein powders, all of that stuff, tryptophan is always the amino acid with the lowest amount in all types of protein. So that kind of is very telling that how little of it we need in the diet and how little we need serotonin in the body. Okay, where to take this now? Okay, so this the same guy that I was just citing, Paul Andrews, the assistant professor in the Department of Psychology, Neuroscience, and Behavior, he and his group published a paper in 2015 called Is Serotonin an Upper or a Downer? The Evolution of the Serotonergic System and Its Role in Depression and the Antidepressant Response. Now, it's a fairly technical article, but basically they have three claims in there and they're supported by a bunch of literature and so on. So first, serotonin transmission is elevated in multiple depressive phenotypes, including melancholia, a subtype associated with sustained cognition. So never mind that. But basically, their first claim is that serotonin is actually elevated in multiple types of depression. Basically, that's what all I should have said. The second claim is that the serotonergic system evolved to regulate energy. It's not a mood sort of increasing hormone. It's a energy regulating chemical, right? And when a person's serotonin is increased by the use of these SSRI drugs, it disrupts their energy homeostasis and actually worsens symptoms initially. That is why some of these SSRI drugs have the so-called black box label that they can increase suicide in the short term, right? In the first 2 weeks. That is because they make people feel absolutely freaking horrible. But what's interesting in a perverted way is that some of them, for example, fluoxetine or Prozac, apparently that one and some other ones, they can actually increase a thing called allopregnanolone initially that actually can give you a feeling of well-being, which allopregnanolone actually is it's a metabolite of progesterone, the hormone progesterone, and it has antidepressive and other beneficial properties, right? So that actually has been some years ago became a FDA approved for treatment of postpartum depression. So they do that. Some of them, they increase the allopregnanolone, which can give people some relief, but then the increase in serotonin can really mess them up, you know, like sexually and just I don't know if you can imagine what it must be like to have very compressed emotional spectrum where the lows are not that low, the highs are not that high, so it's very blah, you know. It's kind of, I guess I'm a bit empathetic, so I can kind of relate to what it must feel like, and it feels fairly horrible, at least when I empathize. Anyway, so then the third claim in that paper from this Paul Andrews dude is that symptom reduction is not achieved by direct pharmacological properties of the SSRIs, but by the brain's compensatory responses that attempt to restore energy homeostasis. So these responses take several weeks to develop, which explains why SSRIs have a therapeutic delay. So they'll tell you it can take several weeks, a couple of months to feel the benefits. So but the benefits you're getting from it is not from the actual pharmacological treatment, but it's from the brain's compensatory responses restoring energy homeostasis, right? So basically poison, right? So you're kind of adapting to the poison, and you know, the body is very good at adapting to all kinds of stressors and toxins and so on. So it's really disgusting what they're doing. Just this is like criminal behavior. Any person that prescribes these drugs is engaging in criminal behavior. And by criminal behavior, I mean causing harm to others. That they're basically causing harm. Whether they know it or not is besides the point. The fact is that they are causing direct harm, right? Direct, okay? Then we have the issue of selective publication of antidepressant trials, right? So in the USA, you have the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. So they have a registry in a results database. So when a drug company wants to do a trial on a chemical, they need to, you know, register it with DEA. That trial is registered. They explain what they're going to do, what they're testing, blah, blah, blah. And then, so this is kind of so the FDA can keep tabs on them, right? So they have these applications for marketing approval, for a change in labeling, or the indications which they can be used in, right? So basically, there's a bunch of researchers that identified this was in 2008 that they published this paper. They basically looked into the database. They looked into the data, and they looked at which trials were conducted related to antidepressant agents, and which of those were actually then published in the scientific literature, which is where most doctors will only look. Very few doctors have the time capacity and so on to dig into what's not been published, right? So it's hard enough to keep, even in a very small specialization and niche, it's very hard to keep up with the literature for a doctor, never mind to then dig further in what wasn't published and stuff like that, right? So this was published, this analysis was published in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2008, like I said, and basically they identified the phase 2 and phase 3 clinical trial programs for 12 antidepressant agents approved by the FDA between 1987 and 2004. So they looked at studies of 12 different antidepressant agents involving 12,500 patients. So among 74 FDA registered studies, 31 accounting for 3,400 study participants were not published. So that was about a quarter of the, in terms of study participants, the 31% of those studies that account for a quarter of the study participants were not published, right? So almost a third of the studies covering a quarter of the study participants were not published. Then according to these researchers, studies viewed by the FDA as having negative or questionable results were, with three exceptions, either not published, that's 22 studies that were not published, or published in a way that, in our opinion, conveyed a positive outcome. So that's 11 studies. So they either didn't publish them if the data was bad, or they published a negative outcome but framed it in a positive way, right? And then according to the published literature, it appeared that 94% of the trials conducted were positive. So if you look at the published literature on antidepressants as a doctor, it appears that 94% of the trials conducted were positive. By contrast, the FDA analysis showed that only 51% were positive. And, you know, now it's a bit more common knowledge that a lot of people know that these SSRIs, they only help, I think, something like 40% of people. I think like something like 60 to 70% of folks that actually are put on them don't actually get actual benefits, right? And what's interesting is that the placebo effect can account for some up to 40% of the benefits in a trial. So, you know, you can give people sugar pills or something else that's inert, and they up to 40% of those, that placebo arm in a trial will report benefits, right? So they always have to, the best research tries to compare the whatever agent, nutraceutical or pharmaceutical, they're using against ideally a blinded, double-blinded placebo arm. So the clinicians or researchers they don't know what the person is getting, so they don't project on them how they should or not or shouldn't improve. And then obviously the patient or the participant of the study, they don't know what they're getting. Most people know, you probably already know that up to 40% of the placebo group in these studies can actually improve. And so that kind of, it kind of shows the power of the human mind and how much we can actually self-heal if sort of given the right conditions mentally and of course physically and nutritionally. But so that's kind of that. 94% of the trials looked positive in the published literature, but only 51% in the FDA database analysis showed were published as positive, right? So goes to show you a lot of fraud and a lot of sort of biases and things like that, manipulation that are just designed to you know, push these things on the doctors, and then the doctors will push them on to their patients, and kind of this merry-go-round of hell continues unabated, really. So there's so much more here to discuss, really. We can talk about serotonin antagonists, right? So this is, I already talked about that cyproheptadine one. What's interesting is there's one called ritanserin. It's a serotonin antagonist described as, you can read this on Wikipedia. It's described as anxiolytic, so anti-anxiety, antidepressant, anti-Parkinsonian, and antihypertensive. So a serotonin antagonist can help with anxiety, depression, Parkinson's disease, and high blood pressure. So does that kind of tell us that maybe serotonin, because when it's taken up by the platelets, if there's a lot of serotonin in the blood, and it's kind of, it can contribute to this clotting processes, these processes, could that be part of why it can contribute to hypertension? Or could it, because it increases other stress hormones in the body, and that stress response being chronically activated will increase hypertension or high blood pressure, for example, cortisol, adrenaline. These things will increase your blood pressure because they're activating your sympathetic fight or flight nervous system, right? It's anti-Parkinsonian, so could serotonin be a factor in things like Parkinson's disease and multiple sclerosis? Could be. Antidepressant, we already saw earlier that serotonin is high in depression, and anxiolytic, so anti-anxiety. So is serotonin just one of those stress hormones contributing to anxiety, insomnia, all of these sort of, this cluster of horrible, nasty stuff that a person can feel? Irritability, anxiety, aggression, self-injurious behavior in, let's say, in autistic kids and stuff like that. So it's very indicative that that is the case, because this specific one, ritanserin, is actually, it was chiefly investigated as a drug to treat insomnia, especially to enhance sleep quality by significantly increasing slow wave sleep by virtue of potent and concomitant serotonin receptor antagonism. So the specific receptors it antagonizes is 5-HT2A and 5-HT2C. So there's a bunch of different serotonin receptors, right? So what's interesting is that ritanserin, according to Wikipedia, was never marketed for medical use due to safety problems, but is currently used in scientific research, right? So it's very interesting. So safety problems with a drug, that has that ever been a problem to push these things on the market? Think of DES, all these kind of estrogens destroying women's health. Think of all these drugs causing people to commit suicide, or things like thalidomide and causing kids to be born without limbs, and all these other experimental things going on. So it's never been an issue pushing things on the market. And look, if there's a big enough public outcry, if enough people die and we have to take it off the market, maybe pay a few billion in fines and grease a few palms and whatever else to make the problem go away, that's totally fine. But this particular one, there was safety problems, right? So it was never marketed for medical use, but it is used in scientific research. And what kind of scientific research? None other than freaking glioblastoma, right? Glioblastoma. This is the most aggressive and most common type of cancer that originates in the brain and has very poor prognosis for survival. So a serotonin antagonist may be used in treatment of this glioblastoma, this most aggressive and most common type of cancer originating in the brain. And not only glioblastoma, but also melanoma, skin cancer, right? So that's interesting. And then cyproheptadine, I already mentioned cyproheptadine. So that was a first generation antihistamine with anticholinergic, antiserotonergic, and local anesthetic properties. Interestingly, it is used as a preventative treatment against migraine. In a 2013 study, the frequency of migraine was dramatically reduced in patients within 7 to 10 days after starting treatment. So is serotonin also a factor in migraines? You know, I know it can also be used for insomnia, this one. Oh yeah, so it's used off-label to treat various dermatological conditions, psychogenic itch, that psychogenic is basically like if you have an itch and nothing is causing it and just something is itching, that's psychogenic, where they cannot figure out what's causing it. But apparently a serotonin antagonist can help with that. Excessive sweating, hyperhidrosis, and a bunch of other stuff, but also insomnia. So a lot of applications for serotonin antagonist chemicals, right? So I guess moral of the story, if I were to say what would be the key takeaway here, is to be aware of this stuff and just be careful what you decide to put in your body. Like I said already, tryptophan supplements, serotonin boosting things like 5-HTP, 5-hydroxytryptophan, which you can get over the counter as a supplement. I would not do that. If you need help with sleep or feeling better, there's better ways to achieve those goals, right? And then on the synthetic chemical side of things, you probably know what my view is. As they say, buyer beware there. Do your own research and stuff like that. Yeah, I think that's all I wanted to cover. I hope you found this interesting and useful. And don't forget, I also offer health consulting. So if you have some health issues, you can just go to my website, read more about how I work, what we do, and then you can book a free intro call with me and we can discuss your situation and I can offer some insights and how I can help. And yeah, if you are in the market for that, would be glad to talk to you, meet you, see where you're at, and would love to help if I can. So thank you for tuning into this episode, and I'll see you on the next one.